time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning David Daly. David Daly is editor-in-chief at Salon, a digital media fellow for the Wilson Center for Humanities and the Arts at the Grady School of Journalism at the University of Georgia. And he is author of the new book, which I can't say the full name due to FCC requirements, but it rhymes with sucked, rat sucked, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. David, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So start out, tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book?
Well, you know, I did not fundamentally understand what happened in 2012 when Barack Obama gets reelected president. Democrats win 25 of the 33 Senate seats that are up that year, and they only take back 7 seats in the House, and the Republicans hold a 234-201 majority there. And I said, boy, that doesn't make sense. And I looked back at it, and it turns out that the Democrats won 1.4 million more votes in the aggregate in 2012 in House elections than Republicans did. And I said, boy, that's a pretty solid number. And it turns out that that's the first time since 1972, only the second time since World War II, that the party that wins the most votes does not take the majority of the seats. So I said, that also seems kind of like an outlier. And as I kept digging, I learned about two things that I had never heard of. A political action group called the Republican State Leadership Committee, and a plan that they devised called Red Map for Redistricting Majority Project. The goal was to turn the House map red in both state legislatures and Congress, and it began essentially after Barack Obama wins his first election in 2008. Republicans realized they were staring at a looming demographic time bomb, and they also realized something devious and diabolical. They realized that the really important election was not the one that they had just gotten crushed in. The truly important election was going to be in 2010, because 2010 is a census year. And after every census year, the Constitution mandates the redrawing of every legislative district in the country, in your state house and Senate, and then usually those legislative bodies are responsible for redrawing all 435 congressional districts. So they hit on a really interesting plan. They said, let's figure out how the redistricting process works in every state, and let's look at how in the next election we can target local races and state races with the goal of having every and the only seats at the table when these lines are drawn after the 2010 election. They raise $30 million for this. It's not that much money in the big picture of American politics. You can barely lose a Senate race for $30 million these days. But that kind of money spread into state and local races in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Texas, Colorado, Indiana, states across the country, was enough to flip legislative districts and give Republicans control of 2/3 of the legislative chambers in the country. So when it came time to redistrict in 2011, they were in the catbird seat in state after state, even in blue and purple states, and they could draw themselves maps that they could not lose on for the next 10 years. So the answer in 2012, when the Democrats get 1.4 million more votes, but are still staring down a 33-seat minority in the House of Representatives, is that the Republicans use the oldest trick in the book, the gerrymander, in a thoroughly modern and devious and brilliant new way.
So talk a little bit more about the history of gerrymandering. That goes back a long ways.
It goes back all the way to the founding of the country. You can trace the gerrymander back to Elbridge Gerry, the old governor of Massachusetts in 1790. His party knows they're about to lose the next election, but again, it's a zero year, so they are able to draw these sort of fanciful swirling districts around Boston in such a way that a political cartoonist says that they look like a salamander, so that they call them Elbridge's gerrymander. The term sticks. And politicians have used this forever. It is not a new trick. It has been a very useful tool to shiv a political enemy, to steal a seat here and there that maybe you don't deserve. It's been a good incumbent protection racket. I mean, essentially every 10 years, the leaders of the two parties in each state get together and do this in a back room in order to, you know, give themselves all the seats that they already had, essentially. What the Republicans realize is that this can be a tool for governing from the minority. And that's what changes in 2010. The 2010 gerrymander is unlike any in our history. And people look past it and people missed this because we assumed it was the same kind of politics as usual. It's not. What they did in 2010 was to use the gerrymander in a whole new way. It was not what we all learned about in eighth grade civics class anymore. This was high tech. It was cutting edge. It was fueled by more money than had ever gone into it before. And there was a political intent behind using this to draw a firewall against the popular will that is going to last the next 10 years. The technology has gotten so good and the map drawing so precise and perfect that there is just about no landslide imaginable that could turn these maps before 2021. And if the Democrats don't get organized before then, they'll be and figure out how to take back these legislative chambers during the next several election cycles, this could continue on for another decade after this.
So to set themselves up, talk about Chris Jankowski and what he did.
Jankowski is the executive director of the Republican State Leadership Committee, and he's a brilliant strategist. And he essentially is the architect of this plan. He's a state government guy, so he understands that if you can get more for your buck in these local races. He understands the nature of the political scene in all of these states. So he looks at a state like Pennsylvania and says, boy, we're going to win the governorship that year. We have the Senate, but we are down four seats in the House. So they target six specific districts. And they spend about $100,000, $150,000 in each of these six districts with the goal of knocking out six Democrats and flipping the Pennsylvania House. In Pennsylvania, the House, the Senate, and the governor have the only three seats at the table when it comes to redistricting. So they draw themselves a congressional map that in 2012, the first time those maps are used, a big Obama year. Obama takes the state by a couple hundred thousand votes. House Democrats win 100,000 more votes than Republican candidates. But the delegation goes 13-5 Republican. So the Democrats get 51-52% of the vote, and they get 28% of the seats. 13-5 in a state that Democrats have more votes. And this plays itself out in state after state. So Michigan that year. 240,000 more votes for Democratic congressional candidates. A 14-person delegation goes 9-5 Republican. North Carolina, pretty much a split, a small Republican majority there. But they take 10 of 13 seats. Ohio, a national bellwether every single year. We all stay up until, you know, midnight to see who is going to win Ohio in the presidency. It's pretty much 50-50 in the aggregate vote for congressional candidates. They've got 16 seats. Those are 12-4 Republican. So 75% of the seats with like 50-point-something percent of the vote. You add all that up in these states, and it gets you pretty close to control of Congress. Moreover, it's just, you know, deeply undemocratic if you believe in the basic ideals of representative democracy and what it means.
And they were very strategic in the way for the 2010 election, the way they managed the campaigns there. They waited till the last several weeks before they did their mailers.
It's amazing. They spent $30 million on Red Map, and about $17 or $18 million of that comes in the last 6 weeks of these campaigns. So essentially, you're talking about the, you know, last days of September, first days of October on. These candidates have got their budgets set, you know, and suddenly, they never imagine that outside groups in D.C. are about to drop six figures on their head, and it blows up these races. You know, it was already going to be a bad year for Democrats. It was an out year. You know, it's a midterm election year after a win. That was a 2010. It was already a tough environment for a lot of these Democrats. This makes it just about impossible. And they take all of these guys down. They take about 700 state legislative seats that year. They sweep down ballot at just the right time. And they take all of these chambers. And more importantly, they are ready in 2011 to go state by state and to redistrict, and to take no prisoners, and to be sure that they super glue these gains in place. They take the spoils of the 2010 victory by remapping aggressively and secretly and like no one has ever seen before in 2011. And then you see in 2012 exactly how well those maps hold up.
And the money that they used for that 2010 campaign, where did that come from?
It is largely raised by the Republican State Leadership Committee from typical big Republican donors. So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, AT&T, Altria, the big corporate money that you expect to see behind the Republican Party. But something else happens that year. I mean, in January of 2010, the Citizens United verdict comes down. And all of a sudden, you can use a pretty much unlimited anonymous dark money that is untraceable and really hard to track. So you can follow some of the big money into Red Map. And then the trail starts to fade a little bit as the money goes back and forth between the RSLC and some of the groups that they're working with on the ground in some of these states. And then if you look at like North Carolina, where there's a vast array of Koch brother type groups under the control of a local Koch brother a type named Art Pope, the money gets really, really hard to track and follow. But it's a bargain basement price to lock in control of a chamber at that kind of money. $30 million for that. It's the political bargain of the century.
And is this happening about the same time as ALEC is really getting up to speed, which
Absolutely.
Primarily focuses on state-level laws?
The thing we have to remember here is that they've gerrymandered the state lines the same way that they've gerrymandered the congressional lines. So you have states like Florida or Ohio where there are super majorities for the Republicans in the House and in some cases the Senate, even though they get fewer votes. It still leads to veto-proof majorities in these states. And that allows groups like ALEC to run completely amok. It's the gerrymandering of Wisconsin and Michigan and North Carolina that leads to things like transgender bathroom laws or to collective bargaining rights being stripped in Wisconsin or to the Emergency Manager Act in Michigan, which a gerrymandered legislature passes. Citizens say no way and they overturn it at referendum. A gerrymandered legislature says, sorry, but we're putting it back. And then that law is used to, you know, take away the management and the government in Flint, Michigan. And you see the water crisis that ensues when they begin trying to run an African-American community that the Republican leadership in Michigan does not care about and doesn't want to spend any money on. And, you know, kids get poisoned with the bad water. There are very real and serious consequences for this at both the national level and at the state level. And it's so deeply knotted up that it's going to take a long, long time to go ahead and undo it.
So it sounds like they've basically set themselves up to be bulletproof, so to speak.
I think that that's what's happened. You have a minority that has locked themselves into an undefeatable electoral position. And when our democratic institutions become bulletproof like that, they cease to be democratic. In 2016, I imagine the same thing is going to happen as it did in 2012. You're going to see 1 million, 2 million, and maybe even a little bit, a bit more than that as a majority of votes cast for Democratic House candidates. It's not going to budge the House of Representatives. And people are going to have to look at this and understand why and get angry. You saw the other day that House Democrats finally got angry about not being able to get any common sense gun legislation through, and they conducted a sit-in. The underlying root issue here, however, is gerrymandering and redistricting. And it's not until you solve the gerrymandering and the redistricting that you have any shot at getting policy outcomes that we actually care about and want to see. That has to be priority one. Until that is fixed, nothing else is going to change. And people can have as many sit-ins on guns as they want. It's not going to change until you redraw the lines in such a way that they are actually effective and responsive to the popular will, the way we all believe that this country is supposed to work. It's not working that way right now.
So it sounds like you gave at least one example of where there was pushback from the states about the decisions that came out of the gerrymandering. So have there been any challenges to the gerrymandering? And are you saying that then we basically have to wait till 2021 for this to be solved?
We only have a chance to solve it in 2021. If we do not solve it in 2021, these lines are going to be locked in and drawn for another 10 years. And the technology that was so good in 2010 is only going to be better and more precise when they use it in 2020. So it is danger time now. I don't see the Democrats taking this issue especially seriously yet. You barely saw – I mean, even Bernie Sanders talking about a revolution. It didn't talk a whole lot about redistricting and gerrymandering, and that is at the root of why all of these policy outcomes come out the way they do. It's at the root of the obstruction of a two-term president. It's at the root of government shutdowns. It's at the nature and the tone and the tenor of the kinds of Republicans that get elected, and it creates the kind of conditions that where a strongman like Donald Trump can waltz in and take control of the party. I mean, it is our politics are a mess, and they're broken and dysfunctional because of the way that we have corrupted the fundamental building blocks of them. At these district lines.
So obviously the Democrats were asleep at the wheel. You can touch on that, but I really want to get to then what are the potential solutions between now and 2020. Are there any states that have an equitable system for deciding what the districts are?
It's really, really hard. We are the only democracy in the world that lets the politicians draw their own lines and essentially choose their own voters. We have to get it out of their hands. Nonpartisan commissions sometimes work, sometimes don't. Sometimes it's just another way of keeping the politicians in charge. When the politicians appoint the members of the nonpartisan commissions, that doesn't necessarily remove the politics from this. You all in Washington seem to have a really essentially fair system of doing this. You know, it's a commission of citizens and wise men and women, it seems, who have integrity and believe in the electoral process. It's the opposite of Red Map, which was about how do we use this as a lever to take control. And what you see in Arizona when a commission comes in is essentially it's just another partisan fight that's taken into a different room. In Florida, they pass a referendum mandating nonpartisan redistricting, and the Republican operatives do an unbelievable job of creating an entire shadow redistricting process, having their operatives draw these perfect maps and then introduce them under names of citizens, sometimes under phony email addresses created by somebody in the names of former interns, or or the maps come in under the names of the wife of the local Republican leader. And they filter these maps in to politicians who were expecting to receive them, and they become the actual districts. And all of this gets unveiled in an amazing lawsuit in Florida, which ended up getting a couple of the districts tossed out and outraged judges who saw it as a conspiracy to, you know, thwart the a constitutional will of the people. So it is a really hard thing to undo, and the intensity that politicians and partisan operatives have on trying to keep control of this suggests exactly how important it is. This is not something that they want pried away, and they have fought secretly and furtively and desperately to hold onto it and to do it in the shadows, and it's only when we can put some light on this process that the rest of us can understand exactly how important it is. It's not boring. It is the fundamental nature of what has to change in order to fix our politics.
So if you were put in charge of, you are the new magistrate for fixing the U.S. electoral system, what would you do to address this?
I think we have to realize that this current system is fundamentally broken. I think we need some radical reforms. We have to think about electoral reform in a brand new way. There's a group called Fair Vote that has really interesting ideas on multi-member districts, on instant runoff of voting, on ideas that take control of the process completely out of the political system and put them back in our hands. Referendums work, and I do think that more states ought to do them. They are a terrific way to educate people on the importance of these lines, and they pass in red states and in blue states, and you know, Ohio, Florida, Arizona, California have all passed, you know, in the last decade, essentially a nonpartisan redistricting reform. It's a really important piece of this. I think people understand at a gut level that something is broken and not working, and we want elections to matter, and we want them to be a conversation about the future of the country and to be about persuasion. And when you have as many non-competitive districts as we do, you don't have to do persuasion. All you have to do is appeal to the angriest base of your party. And these primaries become a battle between, I'm crazy. No, I'm crazier than you are in a deeper and purer way. And it's bad. And you end up with an extreme running too many of these seats and pushing us in a direction where we don't want to go.
So I'm somewhat amazed that so much time could go by before someone like yourself finally collates all this into a book and brings us the horrible news. Where has the mainstream media been on all this?
Boy, the mainstream media still believes that both sides do this. The mainstream media still thinks that gerrymandering is – they don't understand exactly how it changed in 2010. They miss that this was the atomic bomb of redistricting and gerrymandering, that this was a fundamental new way of approaching this problem. And as long as the mainstream media continues to talk about this as if it's just politics as usual, they completely miss how it has transformed our political system from top to bottom.
All right. Well, we were just about out of time. We're talking with David Daley. He is editor-in-chief at Salon.com and author of the new book Rat. I can't say the second word, but it rhymes with sucked. The true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. And so in addition to your book, can people find out more about this via Salon?
Sure. There's a lot of good stories on Salon about this. There's a lot of stories on fairvote.org about this. I think there are people who are finally starting to take this seriously, and there's 5 years left to go before something has to happen. Let's get to work.
All right. Well, with that, we're fortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this
morning. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.